to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Esam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government based in the capital Sana'a has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
We'll be right back. About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014, and we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say, our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India, as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protest through Brussels on Friday was organised by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
While the US beats on drums of human rights violations in other countries, it has less care about the situation of women and mothers in the US. A new study has revealed that during pandemic, mothers in the U.S. were especially likely to report high levels of stress during the public health crisis if they experienced major disruptions to their daily lives at work, their children's schools, or in their interactions with their communities. Due to a variety of factors, researchers said mothers may be particularly susceptible to psychological stress effects from the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, a study by the National Institute of Health in the first 16 months of the coronavirus pandemic found that mothers in the U.S. were especially likely to report high levels of stress during the public health crisis if they experienced major disruptions to their daily lives at work, their children's schools, or in their interactions with their communities, as the majority of people surveyed said they did. The NIH Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes, ECHO program, surveyed more than 11,000 mothers between April 2020 and August 2021, the largest study to date regarding how mothers experienced the pandemic. More than 8,400 respondents reported that their lives had changed dramatically after the World Health Organization declared the worldwide coronavirus outbreak, a pandemic in mid-March 2020, and schools and businesses across the U.S. and the planet were forced to close, furlough or lay off workers, and shift to remote-only models, along with other sweeping changes to daily life. According to lead study author Theresa Bastain, Associate Professor of Clinical Population and Public Health Sciences at the Keck School of Medicine of University of Southern California, researchers chose to examine the effects of the pandemic on the mental health of mothers because previous research has described how they took on much of the burden caused by the pandemic-linked changes to the economy and education system. Mothers suffered a large share of the income and job losses and shouldered much of the responsibility of child care and homeschooling children, the school said in a press release. For example, Pew Research reported in October that for mothers whose youngest child was between the ages of 5 and 12, the average time they spent on secondary child care, supervising children while doing other activities such as working, increased by about 2.5 hours between 2019 and 2020, going from 5.8 hours per day to 8.2 hours. For fathers, this type of child care increased by 1.2 hours between 2019 and 2020. In September 2020, Pew also reported that mothers were more than three times as likely as fathers to have lost their jobs in the first months of the pandemic. Mothers may be particularly susceptible to psychological stress effects from COVID-19 pandemic, reads the new study, which was published recently in JAMA Network Open. School closures impact working mothers, leading to loss of income and complimentary meals in school settings, unexpected child care expenses, and gaps in adequate technology and quiet space for remote learning. The study continues, it is critical to understand the associations between pandemic hardships and mental health of U.S. mothers. The researchers questioned mothers about how much their daily lives changed as a result of the pandemic, particularly about whether they began working remotely, became more isolated due to social distancing guidelines, had less access to healthcare, or got less physical exercise. They also asked respondents if they had shown signs of acute stress disorder, defined as symptoms that arise after or during an event that threatens one's life or the life of a person's loved ones, including anxiety, negative moods, disassociation, avoidance, and sleepiness. Mothers who reported high levels of pandemic-related disruptions were more likely to report such symptoms, according to the study. It really came down to change, and those mothers whose lives carried on much as they normally had did not report as much stress, said Bastian, adding it was the mothers who had big disruptions who reported the higher levels of stress. Although low-income people and communities of color bore the brunt of the pandemic in numerous ways, with studies showing that Black Americans were more likely to be hospitalized for COVID-19 infections and that socioeconomic factors were linked to the increased odds that Black and Hispanic people test positive for the disease, the study published recently showed that mothers with incomes that were higher than $30,000 were more likely to show signs of stress. The high change cluster contained 8,412 mothers and was characterized by higher incomes, higher education, and higher cohabitation. The high change cluster was more likely to report financial concerns as a source of stress. 3,008 participants, about 35.76% versus 925 participants, about 30.22%, and had a higher proportion of white mothers. 5,539 participants, 65.85% versus 1,656 participants, 54.10%. Both clusters had similar distributions of Latina and Hispanic participants. Lower income people who were surveyed were more likely to have jobs in which they did not have the ability to work remotely, noted the researchers, putting them at greater risk for infection. However, along with the privilege of working remotely and being able to quarantine away from other household members, considerable disruption in day-to-day life was also experienced in the high change cluster, including greater social isolation from family, friends, and colleagues, who are important sources of social support when confronted with a major traumatic life event, reads the study, adding, a surprising result was that mothers in the low change cluster reported high post-traumatic stress when they spent more time with family. Spending greater time with family might be stressful for mothers with lower socioeconomic advantage, the study continues, especially if they reside in smaller homes where they may be unable to quarantine away from family members. For mothers across socioeconomic and racial groups, the study shows that we need to think about traumatic experiences like natural disasters, pandemics, or mass shootings more historically. There is a wide range of hardships that women experience from these events that we need to understand, the expert said, adding, so we can protect people from long-term effects.
this one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. In this edition, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the United States right now on an official visit to meet with President Joe Biden and also to address Congress. This is his first foreign trip since the Russian military operation. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the different aspects of his visit and the significance of it. Our guest, Fiorella Isabel, journalist and political analyst, is joining us from Moscow, and also Ray McGovern, who is a former CIA analyst, who also will be sharing his views regarding this recent development.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with Fiorella Isabel. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the U.S. right now. The U.S. has been Ukraine's most important ally in the war, committing more than $50 billion worth of assistance so far, more than any other country. What does this trip, as Zelensky's first foreign trip since the Russian military operation, signify?
Well, this signifies clearly that the United States and its NATO allies are not stopping anytime soon in pushing this proxy war against Russia. And they're, of course, continuing to utilize Ukraine as the excuse, but everybody knows this is really not the case. I mean, Ukrainians are themselves suffering right now, and so are Americans. This is a point I do want to bring up pretty quickly here. I mean, this is just after the United States Congress passed $858 billion defense budget, which is really an offensive budget when we're talking about these weapons that will be used to give Ukraine what they see as a level up. But as we know so far, Russia has maintained its strength in this whole special military operation. And the reality is this money is basically going into places that the public does not know where this money is going. It's going into a lot of pockets. It's going into Zelensky. It's going into weapons for, of course, funding the far right Nazi, neo-Nazi Azov Battalion. And this has not really made a difference thus far. What is the United States thinking in continuing to do this? And I think it's continuing to do this because the American public has not at all responded enough. I mean, you have record high inflation, over 7% inflation. You have sales right now, it's Christmas time, down in retail because people can't afford to shop. You have a housing crisis, you have a homelessness crisis, you have all these problems domestically. And yet, of course, all this money and billions more will be given to Zelensky. That is what has been stated so far by the Western media that Zelensky will be given some money. And this is Christmas time. So it's the juxtaposition really shows that the United States is willing to go to the last Ukrainian, but also perhaps to the last European and to the last American at this point, where all of the resources and the focus, instead of being focused at home, are focused abroad with Ukraine and this sort of using Christmas time to say, well, we have to help Ukraine. I think that's also a part of it as well.
Well, Ray, Fiorella just pointed to a number of different aspects regarding this visit, but something I'd like to pinpoint here is the word proxy that Fiorella used, a proxy war now. And also in a speech to the defense chiefs just a few hours ago, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said that his country is fighting against NATO forces in Ukraine. And of course, we see that Zelensky is in Washington right now. So what is your take on this?
Well, the timing of the visit is very important and very significant. The Congress is turning over. The House is now going to be ruled by the Republicans at the turn of the year. And so here are the Democrats trying to pour or to shoot or to fire hose still more money into Ukraine. Now, as has been pointed out, that money doesn't go into Ukraine. It goes into the pockets of the CEO of Lockheed or Raytheon, the arms merchants that Pope Paul called the bloodstained members of the arms trade. This is what's driving this, plus the fact that the Democrats want to go on record as having done everything they can for as long as they could to save Ukraine and have it meet the Russian onslaught. Now, the Russian onslaught is not going to be met. Zelensky is going to ask for lots more money. He'll get $45 billion more, but he won't get enough tanks. He won't get enough artillery. He won't get enough personnel, armored personnel carriers to make a difference. What he's asking for, what his defense minister asked for, is 300 brand-new tanks, 500 brand-new pieces of howitzers, real effective artillery, and 700 armored personnel carriers. He's not going to get that. And so what does this politically mean? It means that the Democrats can go out from control of the House saying, we did everything we could. Now when the Republicans come in, it is inevitable, short of the use of nuclear weapons, that the Russians are going to run over Ukraine. So part of it is a domestic political calculation. The other part, and this is for what it's worth, my insight from watching the rhetoric lately. 8 weeks ago, President Putin said, you know, Odessa, right on the Dnieper River, we haven't conquered that yet. And the question is whether it could be a Yabloko Razdora, Russian for an apple of discord. If you know your Greek mythology, you know that the apple of discord started the Trojan War, for God's sake, right? It could be a Yabloko Razdora, or it could be a way into negotiations. It could be a way into making sure, how did I put it here? I have it written down because these words are really important. A way of resolving differences, okay? So what he's saying here is that, in my view, Odessa. I can take Odessa, and the Russians can take Odessa quite readily, but I'm willing to stop there, okay? I'm willing to make that not an apple of discord, but a way of getting into negotiations. In my view, the Russians don't want to take all of Ukraine. That would just be a big bother for them. Now, if they get no response in terms of a willingness to really negotiate, they are going to take Odessa. They're going to take everything to Moldova, all the way to Romania, really, in the south. Do they want that? I don't think so. That's a lot to defend. So here is the United States coming back and saying, no, we're not going to negotiate on this. And you people in Britain, you people who read The Economist, don't get wobbly on the war here. We're here for the duration. We're here for as long as it takes. That makes it very different, very difficult, very dangerous, because the people running our war are adolescents, really, and they could get into a temper tantrum to involve even heavier, even more worrisome weapons if this thing is not stopped.
So, Fiorella, since Ray mentioned what Zelensky might be demanding in during this trip, let's also mention that ahead of his trip to Washington, in a briefing, the White House has confirmed that there's going to be a new package worth nearly $2 billion, again, security assistance for Ukraine. And this one also includes Patriot missiles. So what do these Patriot missiles mean?
Well, I mean, this is just more weaponry for Ukraine. But what's been pointed out, and I think Ray did allude to it, is the fact that this is a new phase of this war where it could go either way. Either there's going to be some sort of compromise, and Russia has been openly diplomatic about this whole situation. They have at every turn tried to say, "Hey, we are willing to negotiate, but this has to be fair. It can't be this sort of like, oh, you just have to release every single territory back to Ukraine, including including the ones that have already asked to be a part of the Russian Federation, like Crimea, for a long time." And Crimea has been, of course, another point of contention. But I think this is definitely more so related to the rhetoric that the West, particularly the United States, is leading with Patriot missiles that are directly going to be far more sadistic towards Russia, ramping up this rhetoric that it's going to be any different. And the reality is Russia's military is superior in those terms. And they also have the terrain. They have said that the holidays aren't going to put a stop into what is happening. But when you talk about Odessa, when you talk about a point of perhaps peace and cooperation, we have that opportunity here. I just don't see the U.S. taking it in a way that Russia accepts it. And Russia has long said this: we're not going to accept anything less than this. And I agree with Ray that this doesn't mean that Russia wants to continue to expand westward. They had no intention of doing that. Neither does the army militarily nor politically do they have this intention of doing that. It is far too much terrain to cover. It is far too problematic. And it was never the intention. What was the intention, of course, was denazifying and protecting the people of Donbass. Obviously, that has shifted because of the situation at hand, where the constant supply of weapons to Ukraine will be met with opposition by Russia. And I think we're going to see, going into the next month and the next couple months, is that Russia is going to really ramp up. As Ukraine has continued shelling the Donbass, killing civilians, you're going to see another push by Russia. And a lot of the criticism on Putin and Russia from a lot of the people that have been really watching this is they have been far too diplomatic and far too hesitant in taking what needs to be done, things that people are seeing could have been done for a long time. And these missiles just kind of show overtly that the United States does have NATO troops embedded, obviously, in Russian territory. Russia has said there are already troops in the Russian Federation. So the criticism is, why isn't Russia then? They said if that happened, they were going to respond. There needs to be a response, and I think we're going to see that response in some way to this, not just the rhetoric and what the United States is doing, but just to the moment here. And there will probably be more opportunities for cooperation and for negotiations. But if Russia doesn't get the bare minimum guarantees, they're not going to accept the word of the U.S. and its NATO allies, because that word has been crushed and trampled on so many times. And I think what we're seeing here is the next phase of the special military operation from the Russian perspective, where it's going to be extremely decisive. And we could potentially see the conflict dwindle down. But I just think that the West is really just keen on keeping this process going for as long as possible, extending the war for as long as possible, so it doesn't look like it's losing. So it looks like, oh, well, this is just going to, you know, kind of dwindle off instead of this is an outright defeat.
So, Ray, before we discuss this more from Russia's perspective, you did mention the issue of Republicans and Democrats, and we do know that Zelensky will be addressing Congress. Why do you think he will be going there? What are the issues that he might want to raise?
Well, the Congress, unfortunately, is captivated by the predominant narrative, which has Zelensky winning, of all things. Nothing could be farther from the truth. And the Democrats still rule the House, and I understand that Nancy Pelosi has asked every single Democrat make sure they be there, okay? So this be a test. Do you stand up to the Russians or do you not, okay? They will applaud all of them, including people who voted against the war on Iraq, for God's sake, like Barbara Lee from California. It's unanimous. And so what's in that for the Democrats? Well, down the road, and I think there are enough people who appreciate this, Russia has escalatory dominance there. Look at the map. Russia is going to win probably by this coming spring. The Republicans in the House will be faced with the tough decision as to, as long as it takes, what does it take? Nuclear weapons? I don't think so. So the Republicans will attenuate the conflict, and they will take the rap for not persisting for as long as it takes and being weak on Russia, the mortal sin that can never be forgiven.
Okay, so Fiorella, let's go back to analyzing this from Russia's perspective. Russian President Vladimir Putin has recognized that there has been the tragedy of loss of life, but he also pointed out that this was inevitable. What does he mean by that?
Well, I mean, this is a war, right? I mean, Russia considered this a special military operation, but with the constant supply of weapons from the U.S., the EU, and their NATO allies to Ukraine, Ukraine is basically being held up like a puppet with strings being pulled by NATO, particularly the United States, as the puppeteer master. And so in fighting this special military operation, there are going to be, unfortunately, a loss of life, and that is the ugliness of war. I believe that's also part of the hesitation for Russia, other than the economic factors and that it's in a different position now than it was years ago when the conflict began in 2014. This now is obviously has expanded to not just protecting the Donbass and denazifying these areas, but protecting itself, its existence as Russia, as what it is. Russia is fighting an existential battle to exist, because we know from the RAND documents, we know from U.S. Statesmen that the United States and NATO's plan was all along was to break up Russia using the its own previous Soviet territories, using its own people against it, using its allies against it, creating chaos in the Balkan area, creating chaos in the Caucasus in order to, of course, destabilize the region, sanctioning Russia. We know right now that the EU just passed new sanctions. I believe it's ninth set of sanctions against Russia. And it's trying to basically attack now Russian media and anything that is affiliated with Russia or the Russian government. And that is, of course, targeting its assets. I mean, this is not stopping anytime soon. So what Russia is fighting is an existential war. And I think a lot of people have jumped on that in a way and have looked to the Russian Federation as, wow, they're standing up to the Goliath and they are going into this. And unfortunately, what ends up being war or a military operation is going to cause the loss of life of both Russians and Ukrainians. But let's not pretend that the majority of the loss of life is coming from Ukraine and the weapons supplied to it by the West, constantly shelling their own civilians, their own people in the Donbass. And if you look at Western media, you will see, oh, Russians are continuing to shell Ukrainians in every single headline. Journalism is essentially near dead in the West because you don't have journalistic integrity. We almost started World War III because the AP jumped on a story from a source that wasn't verified because of this. So in essence, yes, a war is always going to bring a loss of life. But what I think Putin is referring to is this is going to be minimal in comparison to what could happen if NATO continues to expand and continues coming in. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is like wanting to surround Russia's border now with Finland and Sweden. So there has to be a pushback. And this is, again, a push towards the existence of Russians as a whole. Putin is definitely not in terms of the way we view nationalism in the West, but in terms of a very patriotic statesman. You know, he's not a communist, but he comes from the Soviet era. He's trying to protect the integrity of Russia, of what it is and what it has been, its culture and every aspect of it. And the only way to do that is to stand up to Western hegemony. And that's what we're seeing before us.
OK, so Fiorella, we're running out of time. A quick answer. What are the prospects of peace at this point right now?
They seem very...
Fiorella.
Sorry. Oh,
just
me.
Quickly.
OK. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see that for at least the next few months.
OK.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Ray, we don't have that much time left. The final question is yours. The monthly cost of defense for Ukraine is reportedly around $5 billion. Who exactly is benefiting from this war?
The war profiteers, the people who sell and make the weapons, and the Congress people who profit from the contributions. I'd like to say one more thing. Obama himself, 6 years ago, said, Ukraine is a core interest to Russia. It's not a core interest to the United States. And Russia has escalatory dominance there. Whoa, what's changed? Nothing has changed except one thing, and that is China. Nobody mentions China.